a special Hanukkah shiur. I was actually going to do Al Hanisim at first, but I didn't really think of anything that I liked to do a full shiur on. I mean, there's always a lot to say about Al Hanisim, but it was kind of bits and pieces and things we've discussed before. So I thought, we'll take a larger theme for Hanukkah, as I called it on the sheets that I sent out, the war on aristocracy. So in order to understand where we're going with this and what we plan on doing, you first have to ask, what is aristocracy? You know, kind of an important starting point. Can you define aristocracy? Someone?
An elite ruling class.
Okay. An elite ruling class, those who are generally considered the best, and they are privileged, right? I mean, the origin of the word, as I understand it, is from a Greek concept, in which it actually was supposed to be meritocratic. In other words, those within society who prove themselves to be the greatest in terms of their character, in terms of their leadership, those are the ones who are able to govern society. That's where it comes from. If you think of Plato's Republic and the idea that a very non-democratic idea, it's not everybody gets to vote, it's if you're qualified, you get to vote. That's the origin of it. But I'm thinking here more about kind of the popular version of aristocracy in which power is inherited. If you are part of the ruling class, then your children are part of the ruling class. And the term that I would most closely associate this with in Judaism is yichus. Even though technically that's not what the word yichus means, yichus literally probably best translated in English as association. You're associated with a trait. You're associated with someone else. You know, that's yachas, to be related to in some sense. Nonetheless, the way that the word yichus is often used, much like the way the word aristocracy is often used, whether it was intended that way originally or not, is to refer to being part of a particular group by dint of lineage, by dint of family relationship, and it's the group that gets the power, the group that gets to be sort of in charge. So is that a fair working definition? If not, you could say so now. Otherwise, you're going to be frustrated for the next, 50 minutes. So, okay. By the way, Hadassah, that's a very nice table in the background. Wish we could be there. Okay. So the Hanukkah actually has two wars on the aristocracy. One historical and one philosophical. So I want to spend some time first on the history one, because I think it's interesting, before we really get into what I think is the more interesting one, which is the philosophical one. The historical one is also interesting. On a historical level, the battle between, the Hashmonaim and the Syrio-Greeks also involved a battle between the religious leadership and the Jewish aristocracy, who were themselves Hellenized. We know that during this period of time, the position of Kohen Gadol was bought by the powerful from the Greek occupiers. Right? Being the Kohen Gadol did not mean you were like Aharon. Being the Kohen Gadol meant that you had the ability to buy being the Kohen Gadol. There's one famous Kohen Gadol whose wife bought it for him, who was actually somebody of great standing in the Jewish community. Did anybody here ever hear of Yehoshua ben Gamla? Yehoshua ben Gamla is the reason that all of you are able to be on this Zoom today. Yehoshua ben Gamla pioneered the education system in Israel, obviously a couple of thousand years ago, in which you would be able to have your child sent to a school instead of having to educate them at home. It's really more complicated than that in terms of what exactly it was that he enacted. Was there a regional system? Was there a local system? I'm not going into that right now. But he is credited with creating the system in which we actually have a school system in the Jewish world. So his wife bought him the position of being Kohen Gadol. I don't know if it was a birthday present or what, but that was something that went on. Those who were powerful were able to perpetuate that power, and among the Kohanim themselves, there were battles among key families for power and influence with the Greeks. There are different accounts of the manipulations. If you read the second book of Maccabees, if you look at Josephus's writings, I'm not expert in it, but I did bring you in source number one from his Antiquities of the Jews. Just one example of this, involving the battle between two Kohanim brothers who are known as Jason and Menelaus. These are names, obviously, that are Greek names that they took for themselves. Before that, they were Yehoshua and Chonio. So there's a whole back and forth between them. You can see it here in source number one. I'm not going to spend time reading it aloud. But what I wanted to highlight for you is the second part of the paragraph. They're from the Tobias family. The Tobias family, that's a name that comes up in all the different records of the stories of that period. Of the Hashmonaim. But take a look at the part where it begins, and the sons of Tobias. The sons of Tobias took the part of Menelaus. They supported Menelaus. But the greater part of the people assisted Jason. And by that means, Menelaus and the sons of Tobias were distressed and retired to Antiochus and informed him that they were desirous to leave the laws of their country and the Jewish way of living according to them, and to follow the king's laws and the Greek way of living. There were battles over the position of high priest between these families. There were battles among the Kohanim, and Hellenization was very much a part of what went on. We also know that the aristocracy went along with the Greek rededication of the Beis Hamikdash to the Greek Lord of the Heavens. Are you familiar with what happened to the Hashmonaim after the events of Hanukkah? After they won. You up on that? Okay. I shouldn't be taking so much for granted. It's just something that I've been, learning about and reading about for so long, and I'm just kind of assuming that that it's in the culture. But that's a mistaken assumption sometimes. So things go bad, like very bad, with the Hashmonaim after Hanukkah. I brought you in source number two Ramban's criticism. Ramban criticizes the Hashmonaim for taking the throne, for becoming kings during the second Beis Hamikdash. He says, Malchus is supposed to be with the tribe of Yehuda. Anyone who's not from the tribe of Yehuda should not become king. This is part of Ramban's whole discussion about how Shaul could be king if he was from Binyamin. So he says that it was wrong for non-Yehuda descendants to be kings, and he says the Hashmonaim suffered as a result. God punished the Hashmonaim afterwards because they took the throne, first of all because they weren't from Yehuda, and second because they were Kohanim, and Kohanim are supposed to be in charge of the Beis HaMikdash. They're not supposed to be functioning as kings. In fact, you may have heard this idea, which is brought in the Sefer Tamei HaMinhagim. People always wonder where Hanukkah is in the Gemara. Meaning, if I ask you where Purim is in the Gemara, you may know there's an entire Masechta called Maseches Megillah, and it has a lot to say about the laws of Purim, unsurprisingly. If I asked you where Pesach is, right, you would say Pesachim. If I asked you where Sukkah is, you would say it's in Sukkah. Shavuos doesn't really have a whole lot. There is a Masechet called Shavuot, but that's about Shavuot, not Shavuot. It's about oaths. The Shavuos has a Gemara in Shabbos that talks about the giving of the Torah. And then in Menachos, we talk about the Karban Omer. We have a Mesechta about the Bikurim. So Shavuos is kind of scattered. But when it comes to Hanukkah, does anybody know where the Gemara talks about Hanukkah?
Hallel?
Nope. The Rambam talks about Hallel in the laws of Hanukkah. Yeah?
I think it's Shabbos.
The Gemara in Shabbos. In the Perek of Bamei Madlikin, where we talk about Shabbos candles, so we talk about which fuel and which wicks are appropriate for Shabbos candles, because you're not supposed to use something that's going to smell bad, it'll drive people away from the Shabbos table, you're not supposed to use something that won't burn well, because it'll cause people to adjust the lamp on Shabbos. And we have a discussion there. Well, what about Hanukkah? What are the restrictions for the fuel and the wicks that you're going to use? That's where you get the discussion. But there's nothing in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi does not include anything about Hanukkah in the Mishnah. And that's a source of great consternation. Like, why? Why doesn't Hanukkah rank? So the Tamei Amin Hagim, which is a very interesting book, interesting is definitely the right word, about, sounds like, Minhagim, but he's got all sorts of other things, I don't know what to call it, in there. But in the Tamei Minhagim, it's in section Tuf Mem Zayin, section 847, claims that the Chasam Sofer said the reason why Hanukkah was omitted from the Mishnah was because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, canonizer of the Mishnah, was a descendant of tribe of Yehuda, and he said the Chashmonaim were wrong for taking the throne, and therefore he drummed them out of the Mishnah. I'm not including Hanukkah in the Mishnah. It's a remarkable idea. I think it's generally assumed to be incorrect, but that the Chasam Sofer had never said it. We certainly don't have it in the Chasam Sofer's own writing. But nonetheless, that tells you a little bit about the disapproval of what happened with the Chashmonaim post-Hanukkah. I brought you in sources 3 and 4 more about what happened with the Chashmonaim after the events of Hanukkah. Source number 3 has to do with a Seleucid king, Greek, by the name of Demetrius, who confirmed Shimon from the Chashmonaim as the Kohen Gadol. And you look at the relationship there, and you see that Demetrius, I'm not reading it aloud, you can see it there, it's from the first book of Maccabees. Demetrius confirms Shimon as Kohen Gadol, gives him a lot of honor because he understands that the Romans have been making nice with the Jews, and he says, I want to have good relationships with them as well. And then you go on to see the powers that he gives to Shimon, and a lot of it sounds like the powers of a king and a degree of royalty, and in particular powers, or not powers, but sort of externalities that we'd be familiar with from the Greeks. The best example of this, or the best text to look at for this, is source number 4. And here I am going to read it from inside so you can see what I'm talking about here. The Hasmoneans themselves quickly adopted Hellenistic mores. They instituted holidays celebrating military victories, as did the Greeks. They signed treaties with Rome and forged close alliances with the upper strata of Jerusalem society, whose Hellenized proclivities, as those of the Hasmoneans themselves, are attested by names such as Alexander, Diodorus, Apollonius. In other words, if you follow what he's saying, and I've read it before, so it's easier for me. But what he's saying is that the descendants of the Chashmonaim not only make alliances with the Greeks and the Romans, they start emulating their practices. They create holidays that celebrate military victories, purely military, it seems, victories. They name themselves with Greek names. And then in the subsequent period of Chashmonai rule, instances of Hellenization within Jerusalem became much more commonplace. The document in 1 Maccabees 14, that's what I showed you in source number 3, recording the public appointment of Simon as ethnarch, high priest, and strategos. Strategos means the military person in charge. Is written in a style strikingly reminiscent of documents from the Hellenistic world. The structure of this declaration, the extensive arguments invoked to justify and explain such appointments, the use of purple robes and gold ornaments by the Hasmonean ruler, the dating of an era commencing with Simon's appointment, and finally recording the text of this document on bronze tablets and placing them in a prominent place in the temple area and in the treasury are all elements borrowed directly from well-known Hellenistic practice. The descendants of the Chashmonaim, the descendants of the Hasmoneans, take on many Greek practices and are criticized for it. Are we clear? You follow? It's a problem. So that Hanukkah starts out, to sum up what we've said so far, Hanukkah starts out as a war of the Chashmonaim against the aristocrats who had made nice with the Greeks. We win the battle. We retake the Beis HaMikdash. We once again have a sanctuary that is dedicated to God. We light the oil. And then after that, those who had themselves defeated the aristocracy become the new aristocracy and take on the same practices as the people they defeated and drove off. You follow? Okay? Not okay. I mean, it's not so good, but okay. Questions and comments on that? That's the history part. That's the history war on aristocracy. Okay, then I'm going to move on to the philosophical war on aristocracy, because to me, that's the one that's even more interesting. The idea that Hanukkah celebrates a war against the concept of aristocracy, the idea that success in Judaism requires special connections to a particular class. I brought you a quote in source number 5 from the Roman Seneca, from the play Mad Hercules. And I recognize that it's a little odd in a Hanukkah shiur to be bringing a quote from, you know, a Greco-Roman source. Nonetheless, I like the quote. So it's in source number 5. Does everyone have the sheet? Just make sure everyone was able to get it off of the email. Okay, good. Seneca writes, "He who boasts his race boasts glory not his own. He who boasts his race boasts glory not his own." What does that statement mean to you?
You can't rely on the successes of the group that you're associated with, that you have to do things individually.
Okay. I hear that. So it's about you're looking at race in terms of the people you are with right now. And saying you...
The group that you associate yourself with, whether that be, you know, like legitimately race, the color of your skin, or religion, or nationality.
Okay. I mean, race isn't going to mean to him color of your skin. That's a later political association. Race to him just means family.
Okay.
Nechama, you unmuted. You were going to say?
Yeah, so I was thinking more of like a people... and you're boasting who you are now and where you've come from. So this is not an individual thing. This is like defeat of how far we've come and as a people and as a nation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if a person says, if a person boasts their race, what does that look like?
I don't think it's arrogant because it's not personal. I think it's just taking pride in who you are as a people collectively.
Okay. And is he for or against?
It seems like he's pro it.
Because? Is he pro it? I would have said not.
I don't think it's negative because he's boasting glory. And he's saying it's not his own. It's a collective thing. It's a nation. It's a people thing. So... I don't take it as negative. I think it's pride and...
Okay.
I think it's almost based on nothing. I mean, I know what you're saying, it's earlier, but it reminds me of Nazi Germany in a way. So there's this, like, pride of something, though, that's not, like, earned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe even a little bit like we said about Yichlis, like, it's depending on something, like, even what you talked about in the other year, it can only take you so far. It's
right.
It's not enough. Thinking, but I think it is like how he's saying it is like is negative. He's looking at them like it's
right. I think he's making a judgment. I think he's saying that if somebody, as Nechama said, takes pride in his ancestry, takes pride in the family from which he comes, and says they were great, therefore I am great, he's making a mistake because it's not really yours. The fact that you have an ancestor who did X doesn't say anything about you. That's what he's saying. So that was my question. Does Judaism agree with Seneca, or does Judaism say no? That actually is your own. Prove it, one way or the other.
I think it's both. I think we agree and we disagree. We agree in the fact that there is the concept of Zuchus yourself and show what you have to offer and, you know, your needos and characteristics and traits.
So you're gonna take the compromise position, right? I disagree with Seneca, but on the other hand, I think that we have to also make our own way, to sum up what I'm hearing you say. So undoubtedly, as with basically every idea in Judaism, we're on both sides. We're not on one side, we're not on the other side, we're on both sides. But I wanted to explore that and find out, so when are we on one side? When are we on the other side? One of my kids complained to me that they had been put some ethical question in class, and the answer, of course, was, it depends. And he's like, I don't like it depends. It depends is not really an answer. What does it depend on? You need to come up with an answer for where we apply X and where we apply Y. Otherwise, what have you accomplished? So the truth of the matter is, we could bring ample sources to show that we do believe in boasting our race, so to speak. You mentioned Zechus Avos. I'm going to come back to that as one example. But take a look at source number 6, a classic Gemara in Bava Basra. Gemara says you should always try to marry into a good family. Moshe marries Yisro's daughter, and the result is that his grandson, a fellow named Yehonatan, becomes a servant of idolatry. Now, there's a whole backstory to that Gemara. I'm not going into that right now. If you learn Shoftim chapters, Yud Zayin, Yud Chet, chapter 17 and 18, you will have a better sense of what that Gemara is talking about. But the Gemara blames Moshe's grandson sinning on the fact that Moshe marries into Yisro's family. Ah, Yisro's a good guy. We like Yisro. Yeah, but look where he came from. He came from Midian. He had been a priest for idolatry. The Gemara says, you know, there's an influence there. Contrast that with Aharon, who marries Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, and his grandson is Pinchas, who's wonderful. Now, this Gemara is problematic on multiple levels. The whole story with Moshe's grandson is problematic. Telling me Yisro is bad is problematic. Not to mention that Pinchas's grandfather was also Yisro, because Pinchas is the son of Elazar, who also marries the daughter of Yisro. So the Gemara itself acknowledges that this story is more complicated than given at first glance. Nonetheless, further along in this Gemara, take a look at source number 7. You get a line that I'm sure you've heard in one form or another. One who marries a woman should check her brothers. You ever hear that one? You want to marry a woman, check out the brothers. Why the brothers? Well, when Aharon marries Elisheva, she is the daughter of Aminadav, but the Torah goes out of its way to say she is the sister of Nachshon. And the Gemara says, why do you need to tell me that? Of course she's the sister of Nachshon. Nachshon is the son of Aminadav. She is the daughter of Aminadav. So I know she's the sister of Nachshon. So on a literal level, I would have just answered, yeah, but Nachshon is the Nasi. He's the head of the tribe of Yehuda, so therefore we single him out. But the Gemara says it's not just that we want to mention him. It teaches that when you marry a woman, you check out her brothers. It's also good if you want to know how your kids are going to do in terms of hair. That's always a big thing because it comes from the mother's brothers. But the genetics aside, or the genetics of hair aside, the point that I'm trying to bring here is that you are looking to their race. You are looking to their ancestry. Marry somebody from a good family. Marry somebody who has good brothers in order to predict what your kids are going to be like, suggesting that we do value that. But not just in terms of marriage and family. Think of the communal roles that we have in Judaism. They tend to be, the communal leadership roles tend to be inherited. Right? The melech, to be a king, is supposed to be inherited. That's one of the big differences between a melech and a shofet, is that it's the melech, the king, is an inherited position. Kihuna, by definition, inherited. And you could make the argument for those two that they have to be inherited for the sake of the stability of the nation, right? You don't want a situation in which the king is shifting from family to family. It can be a disaster for the nation. It's considered good if the kings, in fact, are stable However, the Navi is also supposed to be somebody from a good family. If you take a look at source number 8 of the Gemara in Kiddushin, says, when Hashem chooses to make his Shechina manifest, he only does it upon families with proper Jewish lineage. Mishpachos miyuchasos shebe Yisrael, and he bases it on a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. The a Navi is supposed to come from a family that has good, solid lineage. Even the judge on the Sanhedrin, in source number 9, we are told that if somebody served as a judge on the Sanhedrin, you don't need to do any further investigation of their lineage, because if they're going to be allowed to serve as a judge on the Sanhedrin, they also have to have this strong lineage. So, if you're going to tell me that you don't buy into Yichus, you're going to have to explain King, Kohen, Navi, Shofet, all of them, we care that they have to come from good lineage. Right now, it looks like Seneca is at odds with Judaism. You follow? We clear? Okay. So, I think you do have to acknowledge that there is indeed this strong favoring of Yichus in Judaism, and I think for three reasons. One is what Nechama said before. Zuchus Avos, the merit of our ancestors, right? Hashem tells us over and over and over again that he will remember our ancestors for us. We rely on that when we daven. We say, Hashem, Zocher Chasdei Avos, maybe go Livnei V'neim, right? Hashem remembers the ancestors and he takes care of their descendants. This is a classic Gemara in Brachos. You're familiar with the story. Rabbi Gamliel had a showdown with Rabbi Yoshua, right? Going back about 1900 years. Rabbi Gamliel had a showdown with Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi, political leader of the Jews in his era, descendant from David HaMelech. Rabbi Yoshua disagreed with Rabbi Gamliel on certain issues of Psak, certain issues of Halacha. Rabbi Gamliel shames Rabbi Yoshua in public. In the Beis Medrash, they depose Rabbi Gamliel, and they appoint somebody new to take his place. Anybody remember who they appointed? Hint, Haggadah. Who do they appoint to replace Rabbi Gamliel? Uh-oh. Second hint, 70 years old. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. They appoint Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Harei ani kiven shivim shana. Right? I'm too young. They won't take me seriously. And then his hair goes gray and he says, I'm 70 years old. That whole story. So that's a Gemara in Brachos Daf Chav Zayin. And the Gemara says Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was not their first choice to replace Rabbi Gamliel. They said, we can't pick Rabbi Yoshua because he was the one who was in the fight with Rabbi Gamliel. That's no good. So let's pick Rabbi Akiva. But they say, we can't, because Rabbi Akiva does not have the merit of ancestors to protect him. Rabbi Akiva, either himself or his father, converted to Judaism. So he doesn't have this solid ancestry. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the 10th generation from Ezra, who led the Jews early in the Second Temple, the Second Beis HaMikdash. So with that kind of ancestry, all right, we're going to take Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and appoint him. So the idea that having ancestral merit is beneficial doesn't really mean that I'm special. This isn't actually disagreeing with Seneca. The idea is just that older generations are rewarded when their descendants benefit. It's not that I'm great, it's just that I'm protected. I have a shield. You follow? Are you with me? I'm not losing you? Okay. That's one reason why we value Yichus. Why else might we value Yichus besides Zichus Avos? What would be the reason for valuing Yichus?
It's an incentive to behave well, because the consequences are not just yourself. There's others involved, namely the people that you care the most about, your ancestors, your children, your grandchildren.
That's very interesting. So it's a social incentive.
Yeah, it's like COVID.
Not quite sure I follow that one.
It's not just about, like, protecting yourself. It's about protecting others.
Got it. Okay, so wear a mask and your children get a good shidduch. If we had started that earlier on, people might behave better, you know. Should have thought of that. A social incentive. That's a very interesting idea. I had not thought about that, but it's certainly effective. Why else?
There are less surprises. If you know the families, it's kind of like this expectation or standard.
But is that true? I mean, any one of us can name families that are known as fine, great families and have, you know, members who don't fit the mold.
True. I agree with Nechama. There's still some insurance that even if someone maybe made some wrong decisions or whatever, that maybe they still had either an upbringing or a background or a grandparent.
Right.
Had that been differently, something.
So, yeah, I think there is something to be said for education. The sense that they inculcate their family with certain ideals. We saw that when we talked about for Parshas Chayei Sarah last year, the question of race in Judaism, and Rivka saying, I don't want Yitzchak to marry from the Canaanite girls and all that. We talked about why that was. And one of the ideas that was expressed, although we noted it didn't really apply in that case, but one of the ideas that was expressed was that there is a set of values that are supposed to be passed down. Canaan is a bad guy, passes down bad traits to his descendants. Hopefully, Avram and Sarah pass down good traits to their descendants. There's also the idea of spiritual genetics, right? The Kuzari's idea, which is a very loaded idea and requires real discussion, but he is of the belief that you don't just inherit DNA, you don't just inherit physical traits, but you actually inherit spiritual traits. Your neshama is related to the neshama of your ancestors. So for all those reasons, you do find that yichus can be significant in Judaism. And yet, I'm going to argue, and we're going to see it in the context of Hanukkah, that we reject yichus in a particular context. And this brings us to the question of how you build a sanctuary for Hashem. Hanukkah fundamentally, the word Hanukkah means what? Please don't tell me Chanu Chaf Hei, they camped on the 25th. That's a beautiful idea, but that's not what the word means.
Rededication?
Yeah, it's dedication, right? Chinuch, we educate our children, right? Training. The Chanukah is dedication. Chanukat HaMizbeach, Chanukat HaBayit, and so on. So we were dedicating the renewed menorah, but we were dedicating really the renewed Beis HaMikdash. We took a building that the Greeks had used for their ends, and we dedicated it to Hashem as well. It's in Al Hanisim. They look at the idea of dedicating a space to Hashem, going back to the Mishkan and working our way forward. Who built the Mishkan? First, who contributed to the Mishkan? The Torah tells us.
It was in different stages. It was in the desert.
Yeah. In the desert, who contributed to the Mishkan?
Contributed, and the last people, they got punished for it because they weren't the first to.
Well, we're going to talk about the last people shortly, but Alina, you were going to say? So Bezalel is lead craftsman. We're going to come back to Bezalel. But the contributors to the Mishkan are Kol Nediv Lev. Anybody of generous spirit, anybody who wanted to give, was able to give. And the Torah emphasizes, Vayavohu Anashim Al Hanashim, the men contribute, the women contribute, each one brings from their own experience and their own property for the Mishkan. The builders of the Mishkan, the lead craftsmen, are indeed Bezalel and a holy of. Very deep contrast between the two of those. Bezalel is the king of lineage. Bezalel is the greatest. If you take a look at source number 11, I brought you there. Source number 10 was just the dedication of the menorah and how they beautified it over time. But source number 11 is our introduction to Bezalel. Hashem says, I have identified Bezalel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Yehuda. So number one, he's from that royal tribe of Yehuda. Number two, he's the son of Hur, grandson of Hur. Who was Hur? Anybody remember?
Didn't he wait on the mountain?
He was indeed on the mountain. Before he was on the mountain, what was he? You're right, but before that, the end of Parshas Beshalach. He holds up Moshe's hands. Aharon v'Chur tamchu v'yadav. When the Jews are fighting against Amalek, Aharon and Chur are the ones to support Moshe's hands. And then at Har Sinai, Moshe goes up the mountain and he says, you have any issues? Consult Aharon and Chur. And of course, then Chur disappears and we have the Medrash that the people actually killed Chur because he opposed the Egel. That's its own discussion. But perhaps best of all in his lineage is his grandmother. His grandmother is Miriam. Says the Medrash in Shmos, Rabbi brought it for you in source number 12, that Bezalel is given wisdom and understanding as a reward for his ancestress Miriam. And of course, Yocheved will fit in also as Miriam's mother, but it's really primarily associated here with Miriam. So Bezalel is the winner in the Yichus game. He's got it all. Tribe of Yehuda, grandfather Chur, grandmother Miriam, like what else do you want? And then you have Aholiyav. Take a look at source number 13. Hebrew's on one side, English is on the next. Hashem says, along with Bezalel is Aholiyav, son of Achi Samach of the tribe of Dan. Who? Aholiyav, son of Achi Samach. Who's in Achi Samach? I don't know anything about Achi Samach. I do know something about the tribe of Dan. Dan comes from which of Yaakov's wives? Anybody remember? Danani Elokim v'gam Shama b'koli. Who is Dan's... Sorry?
Bilha.
Bilha. Right? Rachel's maid. Right? The one who's known sometimes as a Shifcha. Right? The instead of coming from Yehuda, from Leah, he comes from Dan, who is from Bilha. Not only that, when the Jews travel in the Midbar, when the Jews travel through the wilderness, which tribe goes first? Yehuda goes first. Dan goes last. They are known as the Ma'aseif L'chol HaMachanot. They gather all the stuff that people drop. If there are stragglers, people who are left behind, yeah, they end up in Dan. Opposite ends of the Yichus spectrum. Bezalel with the Yichus, Aholiyav not. And they are paired together to build the Mishkan. Even with Bezalel, parenthetically, you have a medrash that I brought you in source number 14 that talks about Bezalel and how he earned it. But I'm not even going there right now. I think in the interest of time, it's better that I not. But the Mishkan has an anti-Yichus or a leveling out message. Interestingly, let's go to the other end of the building of the Mishkan. At the end of the building of the Mishkan, they have a dedication period. We read it from the Torah on Hanukkah. For 12 days, representatives of each Shevet bring karbanot. They bring their gifts. Right? For 12 days. Each leader, each Nasi, is going to bring their own gift. But the gifts are all the same. Right? And it always frustrates people when they get to Parshas Naso in the Torah reading, because here we go again. 6 psukim for the gift from Yehuda, 6 psukim for the next one, the next one, the next one, the next one. You're going to take 72 psukim to say the same thing 12 times. And then a summary at the end. Why is it that we spend all that time presenting over and over and over again each one's gift? Because each Shevet gets equal presentation time in the Torah. Whether you're Yehuda or whether you're Dan, it doesn't matter. Everybody gets to present. The Mishkan is built with an effort that is not Yichus associated. Everybody gets in. And then we get to the first Beis HaMikdash. Now, the following can get a little complicated, but I have faith in us. It involves three people who have the same name. That's why it gets confusing. The name is Chiram, or Chirom, as it is sometimes written, or Churam, as it is occasionally written. And it can be a little confusing, but I believe we can do it. Take a look at source number 15, please. When Shlomo HaMelech wants to build the Beis HaMikdash, he turns to Hiram, king of Tsur, and asks him for help. Help with wood, cedars of Lebanon and all that, but also with craftsmen. Take a look at source number 15. Hiram says to Shlomo, this is from Divrei HaYamim, I have sent you a knowledgeable, understanding man, my master craftsman, Huram. He is the son of a woman from Dun. His father is a man from Tyre up north. He knows how to work in gold, silver, and copper. So I'm sending you a craftsman, son of a woman from Dun, and a man from Tyre. And then we have a second craftsman identified in Malachim, source number 16. Shlomo sent and took Hiram from Tyre. This is another person. He was the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a coppersmith. Malbim thinks that actually the Hiram in 16 is the son of the Huram in 15. That's his father is a coppersmith. Filled with knowledge, understanding, and intelligence, .. What I'm getting at is this. Two men are sent to work on the Beis HaMikdash, to lead the craft effort. Both of them have the name Hiram, Huram. Don't get hung up on that. Not worth it. Tell me something. Which Shvatim did they come from? Which tribes did they come from?
Dun.
One of them has a mother from Dun. And the other?
They don't say.
Yeah, they do. Yes, they do. In 15, we are told about the one whose mother is from Dun. In 16, we are told of the one whose mother is from...
Naphtali.
Dun and Naphtali. Right? That's a really interesting thing. They're both from Bilha. So take a look at the Medrash that I brought you in source number 14. Go back up to source number 14, please. Rabbi Chaim ben Pazi said, there is none greater than the tribe of Yehuda, none lower than the tribe of Dun, which came from the maids. God said, let him, Ahaliyav, from Dun, be matched with Bezalel, so they will not mock him, so that no one will be arrogant, for the great and small are equal before God. That was on the Mishkan. And then the Medrash continues to say, the Mishkan was made by these two tribes, and so too the Beis HaMikdash. Shlomo was from Yehuda, and Hiram was the son of a widow from Naphtali. More than that, you guys all just like bought something as we read that it kind of surprised me. That's not meant to insult you, but I am surprised. Tell me again, which tribe was Hiram in source number 15 from?
Dun.
Really?
No, we don't know where his father's from.
We don't know where his father is from. Right? We always follow, there's a discussion in the Gemara in Bava Basra about following the mother's tribe. As a principle, we do not follow the mother's tribe. We don't know. His father's from Tyre. Source number 16. That Hiram. What tribe is he actually from?
Also, we don't know. Is it the father of Tyre?
Yeah.
We're not told. If we don't mention it, then is the father even Jewish?
Says Don Isaac Abarbanel, the man from Tyre may not be Jewish. Your craftsmen who built the Beis HaMikdash alongside Shlomo may be the children of an intermarriage. And they get to work with Shlomo. I mean, they're Jewish. Their mothers are Jewish. But they get to work with Shlomo, who has the best lineage in the world. His father is David HaMelech, to build the Beis HaMikdash. I say best lineage in the world, recognizing the irony, because David is from Ruth, and that's its own story and its own debate. I get it. Nonetheless, the point that I'm trying to make here is that we're supposed to take a lesson here. The lesson that we're supposed to draw from this is when it comes to building a sanctuary for Hashem, Yichus doesn't do anything for you. You can be a Shlomo, you could be a Bezalel, and you could be the son of a guy from Tyre. That's not what Hashem cares about. And the same thing comes up in the second Beis HaMikdash. You know, if you ever learn Sefer Ezra, Alina, you learned Ezra with me. You were in the Shir at the time when we did that. So there are two frustrating chapters. Ezra chapter 2 and Nehemiah chapter 7, in which we get the record of all the people who came to Israel to build the second Beis HaMikdash. And we list everybody. All the families get named. And from 10 different types of lineage. You've got Kohen Levi Yisrael, you have Kohanim who can't prove their Kohanim, you have Avadim, you have the people who were the servants of Shlomo, you have Nesinim. All these different groups are all enumerated at length. I just showed you in source number 18, I didn't bring you the verses, I just said, look at chapter 2 in Ezra, sentences 1 to 64, if you want to see the names of all the families that show up. Why do we do that? So Rabbi Chaim Angel offers an idea here in source number 19. He's not the only one to say it, but I had it in my notes from Ezra Nehemiah, so that's what I used. He says, unlike Sefer Malachim, in which we spend a lot of time detailing the structure of the Beis HaMikdash, in Sefer Ezra and in the account in Nehemiah, we focus on the people. The people are at the center of the activity. It's all about the people with all of their various different lineages and problems. Granted that we do identify the lineages, there is some care there still. Nonetheless, when it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, everybody is able to participate. I won't call it a democracy. I call it a meritocracy. In democracy, everybody gets a vote. In meritocracy, you have to prove it. You have to earn it. And you see that in Hanukkah itself. Who are the Hashmonaim? We already said 45 minutes ago that the Hellenizers, the ones who wanted to be like the Greeks, were the aristocracy. Right? That we already established. But how do you get to be among the Hashmonaim? You had to answer the call. What's the famous call of the Hashmonaim? What does Matisyahu say?
Mila Shem Elai.
Mila Shem Elai. Now, the truth of the matter is that we don't actually have a record of Matisyahu saying Mila Shem Elai. The accounts that we have of what he said, like Book of Maccabees, are all from Greek, translated from Greek. We don't have original Hebrew. So we don't know if he said Mila Shem Elai. However, what we do know is source number 20, which is after the Egel, after the golden calf. Moshe says Mila Shem Elai. I read an article which claims that Mila Shem Elai for the Hashmonaim comes from Yosifon, which is an early medieval history book. But in any case, the account you see in the Book of Maccabees, the first Book of Maccabees in source number 21, has him say, hang on one second, I stapled this wrong, has him say, whosoever is zealous of the law and maintaineth the covenant, let him follow me. That's a lot more wordy than Mila Shem Elai. But in any case, the point is, that's all you have to do in order to be part of the Hashmonaim. You don't need special lineage. You don't need to be a Kohen. You don't need to be from Yehuda. Judith is her own topic. I gave you a link in source number 22 to a shiur I gave about Yehudit. But even though she is listed with lineage in the book of Yehudit, the emphasis there is actually on her being a widow. And in that society, you see how the Torah warns you over and over again to take care of the almana, to take care of the widow. She's not of high social standing. And yet, she becomes the heroine of the story. Not only that, this year there's only one Shabbos for Hanukkah. But some years you have two Shabbatot. And the Haftarah for the second Shabbos of Hanukkah is Vayas Chirom. About that Chirom we mentioned, the one who may be the child of an intermarriage, the one who's certainly from Dan or Naphtali, that's who we read about on the second Shabbos of Hanukkah. So what this means is that, yes, I have a Yichus-oriented approach to marriage, I have a Yichus-oriented approach to hierarchy, and meaning communal leadership, and yet I have a meritocratic Mishkan, Mikdash, and Hanukkah. And I think the way to resolve this is to recognize the following statement, which is kind of a bomb to drop with 6 minutes to go, but but I think it's an important principle anyway. Maybe we'll revisit it at some point. Judaism likes its rules, but Judaism loves the exceptions to its rules. This is a very broad idea. It applies, for example, to the many cases of Horas Shah, special dispensations, special rulings, which we find in Tanakh, which we find in the Gemara. But it applies also to passages of Gemara and Medrash that give examples that break the rules of the hierarchies we mentioned earlier. We said, in order to be a Kohen, you have to be descended from Kohanim, right? Except Pinchas became a Kohen, and it wasn't because he descended from Kohanim. Pinchas was born before Aharon became a Kohen, and therefore, as the Medrash tells us on the opening of Parshas Pinchas, Pinchas had to earn Kahuna by dint of his activity in the story of Zimri. Pinchas is not born into the Kahuna, and yet he earns it. We said that a Navi has to be someone who is Miyuchas. Except last Shabbos, Parshas Vayishlach, what did we read for the Haftarah? What's the Haftarah for Vayishlach? Uh-oh. The Haftarah for Vayishlach is the entire Sefer of Ovadia. It's one chapter, 21 psukim. If you ever want to learn a Sefer quickly, there's your Sefer. So, Ovadia, we're told in the Medrash, was actually from Edom. He converted to Judaism, and he becomes a Navi. Shmaya and Avtalion, not only authors of Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, but also judges on the Sanhedrin, Rebbeim of Hillel, they converted to Judaism. They're not Jewish from birth, and yet they become accepted as judges on the Sanhedrin. So that the same Gemara, the same Medrash that insists that we care about Yichus for all of these things, also presents exceptions to the rule. And one of the exceptions to the rule is that while we like hierarchy in many instances, we love the exception when it comes to building a mikdash, when it comes to celebrating Hanukkah. We have a rule that gives preference to those who have great ancestry. It gives preference to the aristocracy. But when it comes to joining Hashem, to coming close to God, anybody can earn it. And you could bring a wealth of sources to support it. Abraham comes to Hashem. Who's Abraham's father? Terach. Most Jews descend from Lavan via his two daughters, Rachel and Leah. On Shavuot, read the book of Ruth about a woman who converted to Judaism. Not to mention she's from Moab, not a favored nation in the Torah. You could bring so many sources to support this. There's even, I brought you in source number 24, a source we've discussed before, about Torah scholars not having children who become Torah scholars, lest people think that Torah has to be an inheritance. Longer discussion. Source number 25, they evaluate a particular sage. Someone wants to recommend the sage, saying, well, you know what? He's 10th generation from Elazar ben Azariah, who was 10th generation from Ezra. And Rabbi Preda in the Gemara in source number 25 responds and says, that's great, but is he a Talmud Chacham or not? I don't care who he's from. There's much, much more to say. But the practical application of this is to say, anybody can come close to Hashem. It's not about your family. It's not about where you came from. Whether in terms of learning Torah, whether in terms of davening, whether in terms of building a mishkan, it's not about where you come from. It's about where you're going. I gave you a bunch of review questions there. I'm not going to go through them, but hopefully, you know, if anybody wants, they can fill out the review questions and send them to me, and I'll grade them. That's my commitment. But I'll just show you source number 27, which I really, really like. It's a story in the Sefer Imrei Shammai on the Chumash. And it's one of these stories that could have happened with anybody. I have no idea who's involved, but it doesn't matter so much. Amru al Chacham Echad. They said about a particular sage, Lo mi mishpacha miyuchases. He was not from a family of lineage. that at some point there was an ignorant and unlearned person who was jealous of him. Somebody who was ignorant, we don't know the full story, was very jealous of him. Started a fight with him, saying, "Hareini miyuchas yoster mimcha, I have better lineage than you do." So the Chacham says back to him, "Becha hayichus mistayim, uvi matchil hayichus. With you, the lineage ends. With me, the lineage begins." I think that's a very powerful statement. And I think it's consistent to go back to the beginning with what Seneca had to say. It's not about the people who came before you. When it comes to connecting with Hashem, it's about what you're going to create yourself. And I think that's an important idea to remember on Hanukkah when we're dedicating the Mishkan, or dedicating, I should say, the Beis HaMikdash, that all of us have the ability to do that. And that's my second war on aristocracy found in Hanukkah. The first one was the historical one. The second one is the philosophical one. Okay?
Thank you. All right. Is it recorded?
Yes.
Okay. Will you send the link? Do you usually send the link?
So I stopped sending the link at some point, but I can send the link, yeah.
Can you send it and I'll post it in the group just for whoever wasn't able to be here?
Yes. Thank you. I believe that there, I'll just send it to you and I have to send that to everybody and then everybody will get it off of that.